From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Should North Carolina expect a blue wave in this year's elections? Will voters heading to the polls cast their votes based on Donald Trump? A veteran North Carolina political strategist addresses these and other key election questions. A recent report suggests North Carolina's state government has too many supervisors, but state agencies have been pushing back. You'll hear highlights from a recent legislative debate on the topic. The word liberal has undergone major changes in the last 200 years. You'll hear from one recent Duke University speaker who would like to restore the original meaning. And we'll highlight a new report that grades teacher preparation programs at colleges across North Carolina. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
The tax filing deadline is passed, and by now you have most likely paid your state tax bill for 2017. Now, for a lot of folks, seeing how much we actually paid to the state makes us wonder how that money is being spent. Joe Coletti is senior fellow for the John Locke Foundation. He's a fiscal policy analyst as well, which means he is the guy who has the answers to that question. Joe, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
All right. So the average tax bill in North Carolina, those of us who pay personal income tax, how much is going into state coffers?
That's of the 4.8 million people in North Carolina who pay who file taxes, the average payment is about $2,500. And so to answer the question that you started with, where does that money go? The three biggest places where it goes are education, healthcare, and public safety, with the biggest portion of that being in K-12 education, followed by universities and Medicaid.
In fact, education gets a huge chunk of the overall operating budget. What's the percentage about, to give people a sense of how big and how much we spend on all types of education?
Right. So of the $2,500, I'm going to be doing math as we talk. It's about 60% of the total general fund is that. That's the North Carolina taxpayer portion, because what we don't talk about when looking at what North Carolina spends, what we need to include is the federal funds that come in. And so Medicaid, which is, as I mentioned, about the same amount as universities. When you look at the general fund, when you add in $10 billion worth of federal funds, that becomes the largest item in total spending. But when it comes to just the monies that we paid in North Carolina, that's K-12 education is by far the biggest chunk.
And Joe, just to help people understand further, when we talk about that average of $2,500, right. That's the average amount that the average North Carolinian pays in state taxes. So education itself would take up $1,452
right.
of that $2,500. And then when you break it down further, you're talking about $984 that goes to K-12. $317 to the university system and $122 to community colleges. So it is a huge portion of the budget. But second in line is health and human services. Tell us what makes up that amount of money.
Well, the biggest portions of the health, and we've broken out human services from the rest of health in this table. So the biggest portion of that is Medicaid, which is at that $317 that you mentioned for universities. The next biggest chunk of that is mental health, which is $76. Then public health and a few other areas also get some of that funding.
Joe, we hear a lot about Medicaid. In fact, you analyze and write about it, as do others here at the Locke Foundation. Why is it such a huge chunk of the budget? Who's covered by this?
Well, it's about 20% of North Carolina's population. When talking about who and how much end up being two different things. So most of the money gets spent on the elderly, and those with disabilities who need long-term care. Most of the people who are on Medicaid, though, are children and moms of children. So families that are of low income.
So when we put together the education piece of the budget and the health piece, including Medicaid and mental health, boy, that is a – there's not a whole lot left to cover everything else.
No, there's not. And once you add in public safety, you're up to 92% of this, of spending. The kind of troubling thing is that the next biggest item after those three, it's kind of a magnitude smaller, but is still the next largest piece is debt service. And the concerning thing about that is that's where we are right now with record low interest – with still low interest rates and before all of the Connect NC bonds are brought online. And so that's going to grow over the next
few
years.
When you say debt service, essentially that's the payments we have to make on money that we borrowed.
Right. Right.
And you think that's going to grow because of the bond package?
Yeah, because the amount of debt that North Carolina has taken out has been going down over the last few years as we've been paying off debt. And as interest rates are starting to rise again, that means that any money that we borrow from now on will be at will be paying a higher interest rate on. The state has refinanced a lot of the debt that it had before to the lower interest rates, and so any new debt ends up at a higher interest rate, and it's on a larger amount of money.
Joe, there might be some folks who are listening and who are thinking, well, sounds like we don't have enough money. So that means we need to raise taxes or find other ways to pay for these things. But you take a different view. You're more fiscally austere. Tell us about what your recommendations are.
Wow, I don't like the term austere. I'll go with I'm more Dave Ramsey school. That you know,
okay.
you can never out-earn your stupidity, right? So if you're going to spend too much money, right, the first step is you have to take a look at how much money you have available, and that can be changed. But that's the first step, and so you look to live within the means of what's there. And so on education, that's part of that is involves choice. On healthcare, part of that is out of our discretion because so much of that is paid by the federal government. And we've begun taking a look at public safety, particularly within the prison system. We've done a lot of work in the legislature and Governor Perdue actually 7 years ago had the Justice Reinvestment Act, which helps bring spending down and move people out of prison and into lower level of handling of their crimes that allows them some more opportunity to reestablish their lives. But so those are some of the things that we're taking a look at. And within each area, it's a question of how does the money get spent? It's less a question of how much, but how does it get spent?
And you clearly believe that there are definitely ways to be more efficient with the money that is being paid in by taxpayers so that it's not an issue of trying to find more money. It's just how you spend it.
Yeah. And the legislature has been really good over the past few years. They've been keeping spending down at about 2.5% growth, which allows for a lot more, which provides more room to set that money aside to take care of those long-term needs, pensions, healthcare for retirees, and savings for the next rainy day.
Joe, we know that the state has been on a very positive economic track for the last several years. We've seen a lot of tax reforms, tax cuts. We've seen regulatory reforms as well. What happens sometimes, as you have described in some of your writing, is that sometimes a complacency sets in and say, hey, things are going well, and maybe people are thinking, oh, let's spend a little bit more. You're cautioning lawmakers to not do that.
Yeah, especially with what we're taking a look at with the revenues that to be coming in over the years ahead, and with the value of the tax reforms that have been in place and that will be taking effect in January of 2019. They really do need to keep that spending at that same level of 2.5% into the future. That is the only way to have sustainable spending and be able to take care of the other needs.
Well, Joe, you have also put together a really helpful document called The Budget in Pictures. Mm-hmm. And it's a really easy way for people to visually understand all sorts of things about the state budget and where the money comes from and how it's being spent. Give us kind of a few things that you'd like people to maybe take a look at if they go to johnlock.org and click on Budget in Pictures.
The first place to take a look would be, you know, at the front of the book, we talk about what is the state of the spending. And then later on, we have that 2.5% growth that the state has to live within. And those are two of the places that I would begin with.
It's a really interesting document, and again, it's very easy to understand. It's meant to be visual, so it's not a difficult read. It's meant for folks to take a look and easily understand. You can find that, the budget in pictures, at johnlock.org. All of that data coming from our guest, Joe Coletti, who is Senior Fellow for the John Locke Foundation. Joe, thank you very much.
Thanks, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Are we in for a blue wave this election season? Will the election serve as a referendum on Donald Trump's presidency? Who's enthusiastic about voting this year? Our next guest is paying attention to all of these questions. Mark Roderman is a longtime political strategist and host of the weekly program Front Row with Mark Roderman on UNC TV. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
So this is going to be a big election. What are you focusing most of your attention on?
Well, there's a lot at stake, obviously, whether the Democrats can retake the House. There's a 24-seat margin right now. Democrats are targeting they say they're going to play in 60 congressional districts. I'd say they're realistically they'll target about 60 districts. I'm not bought into the blue wave yet, but there are some signals that are not good for the Republicans. One, they lost Pennsylvania 18, which was a special election, which was a 20-point Trump district. They didn't really have a message. The Republican Party threw in $12 million and they still lost. Now, part of that was candidate. Okay. They had a pretty bad candidate. The second thing I think was really bad, was bad for Republicans is that the Democrat, being a guy named Lamb, took the Republican message. I mean, he was pro-life, pro-gun. He was against Pelosi. So they're starting to find Democrats who fit the district, like the old Blue Dog Democrats. And that was a strategy employed by the Clinton team back in the 90s, but it hasn't been done since the progressives have been in charge. But a lot of Democrats are moving away from Pelosi, and they're talking to their district directly. So that's not a good sign for Republicans. But the other thing, when you talk about stakes, the stakes are if they do take back the Democrats, take back the House. I would say to you that they'll immediately in January go to impeach or put articles of impeachment on the floor to impeach Donald Trump.
Yeah, what happens if you have the House taken over by Democrats and also the Senate? I mean, if that flips for some way.
Well, I don't think that's actually doable this year because I think there's more competitive. Democrat seats right now. I think Claire McCaskill's probably gone in Missouri, and there's a lot more Democrats up for reelection this cycle. However, it may make a lot of Republicans tentative on the impeachment issue if the Democrats retake the House.
We are chatting with Mark Roderman. He is the host of the weekly program Front Row with Mark Roderman. You can see it on UNC TV every Friday night at 8:30, also on the North Carolina channel, 9 o'clock on Friday, then again on Sunday, 12:30 in the afternoon.
Well, 4 o'clock Saturday on the UNC TV North Carolina channel. For those who want to get up at 3 p.m. in the morning, you can watch it at Saturday. Or, of course, you can watch it online. And then, of course, we're on 9:30 on the UNC TV North Carolina channel and 12 noon on PBS UNC TV on Sunday.
many of opportunities to see Front Row with Mark Rodman during the course of the weekend, your first opportunity being 8:30 Friday night on UNCTV's main channel. So the elections are going to be very interesting. What are going to be the main things you're looking at between now and November?
Well, can Republicans sell the tax cut? Can they sell it to the blue collar? Can they sell it to the middle class? I haven't seen an effective message out of the Republicans yet. That's a problem for them. They've got to get it down to the blue collar. I think there's a real disconnect, Mitch, between the Democrat Republican consultants who make a lot of money in D.C. who don't understand the middle class or frankly, the blue collar out in middle America, out in what they call flyover country. I mean, again, they spent $12 million trying to get a message in Pennsylvania 18. I think they have to reach the blue collar. And I would say I would have blue collar women saying we've got more take home pay. Those are the people who run the households, and they haven't felt it yet, or they're not being told that effectively that it's working for them.
Speaking of messaging, you mentioned earlier Democrats moving away from Nancy Pelosi. It seems as if Republicans, much of their campaign has been vote for us so you don't get Nancy Pelosi. Is that going to be an effective strategy?
I don't think that's an effective message. I really don't think that's an effective message. I think they have to have a positive message out there of what's transpiring. Trump has a very positive message. He rolled back regulations. They have something to sell, which is effectively a tax cut. They cut taxes on the middle class. Businesses are starting to cut taxes on individuals. Corporation, that's starting to work. We're hiring more people. But that story's not being told. I mean, frankly, one of my old mentors who could carry this ball is no longer with us. Jack Kemp had a positive message. We have no Jack Kemps out there in the Republican Party at this time.
That has been one of the challenges for Republicans for quite a while, is coming up with that good, positive message. Do you see anyone on the horizon there who really can do this sort of thing?
Well, you know, I've encouraged Mark Meadows to do that and other folks like that to carry the ball, because you can't just be against Nancy Pelosi. And on the other hand, the Democrats just can't resist. They have to have a message. I don't know today what the Democrat message is or the Republican message, to be quite frankly, going into the midterms. One thing I will say, though, the Republicans would be smart to localize every race.
Some people listening to us are probably thinking, all right, well, just how big a deal are these midterms? Should we really be paying attention?
Well, you know what happens is, you know, Mitch, they always say this is the most significant election of our time. But for Donald Trump, it really is. Because if you start 2 years of impeachments going into 2020, nothing will get done in Washington. Some of us would advocate for that, actually. But I do think you're looking at illegal immigration. You're looking at making the tax cuts permanent. You're looking at a foreign policy that's stable. And frankly, I think American people are looking for more certainty from the Trump administration and not all these changes and all these turnovers 24/7.
Yeah, you mentioned that if you have impeachment starting, there's really no chance for any part of the Trump agenda to be moving during that next 2 year period. That also means probably harder time getting even appointments through, even if they continue to have
a
Senate.
Well, yeah, they've already slow walked the appointments so far. Where Trump's legacy is, and one thing I neglected to mention, okay, the lower courts, lower federal courts, he's done an excellent job. Mitch McConnell's done a good job on that. And the Supreme Court. And it's likely that he might get two. At least Supreme Courts before people through. He's already got Gorsuch, and maybe one more prior to 2020.
Yeah, that'll be an important thing. So in our final moments, when people are watching the news, reading their newspapers, what do you think they ought to be paying attention to?
I'd be looking at what's transpiring to actually really help their lives. And what is the agenda items that are helping their lives? And I'd be looking at the economy. And as you know, if the economy is doing well, that's probably a prerequisite. That's pretty good. That's probably a bellwether for Republicans. If the economy is doing real well, one thing I failed to mention, and I will say this, managed trade, what the president's trying to do, could have a very adverse, and I'd watch that, a very adverse reaction for the economy.
Well, it's going to be a very interesting election season. One person who's going to be paying very close attention to it and talking about it each week on UNC-TV is our guest, Mark Roderman. He is the host of the weekly program Front Row with Mark Roderman. You can see it several times during the course of each weekend, starting at 8:30 p.m. on Fridays.
Following Washington Week.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State agencies are pushing back against a proposal to reduce the number of government supervisors. The plan comes from the General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division and Director John Turcott.
You kept hearing there's no definition, there's no standards. We've heard that before. We say there needs to be some standards and needs to be some definition. I know I've worked in several other places. And in North Carolina, relatively speaking, it's much easier to get new positions approved, to get salaries reclassified, to get increased positions here, to maintain a vacancy rate that's higher than average. We don't take attrition savings off on the front end of budgets. And so I can tell you that there is savings out there that could be accomplished.
Lawmakers echo Turcott's concerns. State Representative Craig Horn.
In one particular agency, I think I counted 20 well over 28 directors, all of whom made north of $90,000. I couldn't figure out what they all directed. And I see in the same thing as I've at other job descriptions or supervisor. It says on the org chart, so-and-so's name, supervisor, and it's unclear what they're supervising.
Senator Chuck Edwards.
North Carolina ranks 32nd in terms of state employees per 10,000 citizens, meaning there are 31 states that are doing a better job than us if we're looking at efficiency. That right there tells me that there's something we can do different or better.
Senator Andy Wells mentioned a proposed 1-to-8 ratio between supervisors and employees.
I'm getting a lot of messages from administrative folks that this seems to be a bit of a legislative overreach, that they don't want us looking at how they run their departments. Let's go back, though, in history. We're not talking about something that PED came up with, a 1.8 ratio. The 1.8 ratio goes back to 1996, 22 years, five administrations ago. It was set up during the third term of Governor Jim Hunt, and I would argue that there's nobody in this room that knows more about the inner workings of state government than Jim Hunt did in his third term. They said 1-to-8. And nobody in 22 years and five administrations has been able to hit it. When do we get involved? Having more supervision than is necessary is costing our taxpayers money.
You've been listening to legislators discuss a proposal to reduce the number of state government supervisors. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. We often hear debates pitting conservatives against liberals, but those debates often misuse the term liberal. That's the argument from Deirdre McCloskey, professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago and recent lecturer at Duke University.
I want to try to persuade you to change the way you talk about politics and maybe the way that you think about it. And the main sort of takeaway I want to persuade you of is to change the way you use the word liberal. Liberal doesn't mean what it once meant, which is an economic and social and political policy for a free people, where everyone's free, where poor people are free, where black people are free, where women are free, gay people, all religions are free. That's the basic definition of a liberal, is someone who believes in this free society and doesn't think that the state, the government, is their mother, or worse, their father.
McCloskey says misperceptions about the word liberal are linked to political debates about the left versus the right.
Here's how to think of it. The left-right axis is an argument about power. It's an argument about how to use state power. On the left, my friends, my many socialist friends, want to use it to extract money from rich people, say, and hand it out to other people. And they want to have an expansive government of some sort, and not just of some sort, of a very particular sort, a redistributive government, and they want to use force to do it. Now, this you may, if you're of the left, you may say, oh no, we don't want to use force. But if you're involved with the state, the government, you're involved in, with using force. The classic definition of a government was by Max Weber, the great German sociologist and economic historian, in 1919. The state is a monopoly of legitimate violence in a certain territory.
That's Professor Deirdre McCloskey of the University of Illinois at Chicago, delivering the recent Hayek lecture at Duke University. McCloskey says real liberals have a different view about the use of violence.
I don't want anyone to use violence. And that's the key to liberalism. Liberalism, in the correct classic definition, so distorted in American politics, is the theory that human beings can get along by leaving each other alone, mostly. Not by disdaining each other, not talking to your Muslim friends or something, but by strictly leaving people alone, not pushing them around. There's this violent spectrum from left to right, and then there are the liberals, the real ones, moi. And they're up somewhere, they're on another axis. You may say they're on another planet, but they're not. They believe in free exchange, free speech, the whole of the First Amendment. They believe in letting people alone and not obstructing them, not using the government to put hooks and chairs in their way, which is what both the conservatives and the left, let's start calling them progressives, because that's what they want to be called now, are interested in doing. And as I said, I'm not against all government. I think that would be kind of crazy, but because you do need government against bad people, against robbers and against force and fraud. Because if we had no government, we'd have the war of all against all, and the life of man would be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. So I understand the case for government. But you don't need to go to the Hobbesian extreme, the Hobbesian extreme of a government of the size we have these days.
McCloskey placed the size of the current American government in historical perspective.
In 1910, the size, the expenditures of all levels of government added all together in the United States was 7.5%. So it's state, local, and federal. 7.5%. Now it's 35%. What is this? What do we get for 35%? Do we need to get things from the government? Agricultural subsidies, corporate welfare, large military expenditures, masses of bureaucrats at the state and local level, hassling people about getting licenses to braid hair. Is that what we need? In the United States, there are 1,000 occupations that require a government license. 1,000. Hair braiding is the most egregious example I've heard of, but I'm sure there are worse cases. In order to braid hair, you need to go to, I don't know, hair braiding school for a year or two, and then you'll get, if you pass the hair braiding exam, I guess, I don't know, it's like a final exam in a course, then you get to braid hair. Now, this is a great oppression, especially on the African-American community, because they're the ones who do a lot of hair braiding. So it's a completely crazy law.
McCloskey asked the Duke audience to think about its own views about the use of violence and the proper role and size of government.
I want you to use or start thinking about what kind of society you actually want to be in. Do you want liberty? And if you do, consider becoming a liberal. And it doesn't mean being cruel and nasty to the poor. In fact, as they say in France, au contraire. A true liberal, John Stuart Mill, Adam Smith, they were very generous towards the poor and wanted to help the poor. But they wanted to actually help the poor. They didn't want a virtue signal, which is one of the big problems with the left and the right. They're both virtue signaling instead of adopting policies that would actually help the poor.
That's Deirdre McCloskey, professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago and recent Hayek lecturer at Duke University. McCloskey wants free market, limited government supporters to reclaim the label liberal. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. The National Council on Teacher Quality has released a report on teacher preparation. And it turns out that several North Carolina University teacher training programs rank very high on the report. Dr. Terry Stoops is here to explain who and why. He, of course, the Director of Education Studies, the Vice President for Research for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
So first of all, how does this report actually measure teacher education, teacher training?
Sure. The National Council on Teacher Quality looked at three main variables. The first is admission criteria. In other words, how do these programs determine who gets admitted to the teacher education program in the first place? The second thing that they looked at was knowledge. In other words, once they're admitted to the program, what do they learn? Do they learn the basics of math, of English, and the content knowledge they need to be successful when in the classroom? And the third thing they look at is practice. And this would cover things like their student teaching and classroom management. In other words, how do they handle kids when
they're
getting out of hand?
That's
exactly right. And these really are the three essential components to really training a good teacher, is not only making sure that you have the right people, but that they learn the right things, and then they know what to do in the classroom and the right way to be a teacher once they get there.
Now, you really drilled down into this report, and you found some interesting information about several North Carolina universities. Who's doing well, according to this report?
Well, it looks like, first of all, that our private colleges and universities are doing very well. And we talk so much in the state about the UNC system schools just because they're so large and there are so many students that come out of there with teaching degrees that we tend to overlook some of our private colleges and universities. Elon University, for example, High Point University did really, really well in this ranking. Meredith College also did very well. That's not to say that some of our large state universities did not do well also. Appalachian State, for example, has a very good teacher training program. East Carolina did very well in some of the categories. But it was really the private colleges and universities that excelled. And the programs that were focused on by this study are undergraduate and graduate programs in education and special education programs. And it looked at 81 of those. The fact that our private colleges and universities did so well when looking at across a number of different types of programs and number of different types of universities really is a testament to the fact that there's some innovation going on there that is often overlooked when we talk about teacher training in North Carolina.
When you mentioned the three components that really made up the analysis and the ranking in this report, I thought the first one was really interesting. You said essentially who they admit into the teacher education programs. Are we able to tell at all from this report or perhaps other things that you have been reading what it is, the characteristics that really lead to an effective teacher in the classroom?
That is really the golden question right there. It is hard to quantify what combination of characteristics combined to create a great teacher in the classroom. For example, you can have an incredibly intelligent person that knows all the content knowledge but gets in front of kids and can't teach at all, and those kids run roughshod over them as they try to teach. You can have someone that is very personable but doesn't have the content knowledge necessary to be able to communicate to those students in an effective way, be able to teach them so that they learn what they need according to the state standards. So it is very difficult to quantify. Mostly you want to look to make sure that those fundamental skills are in place before they're admitted to the teacher education program. In other words, do they know the basics of computation? Do they know how to write? Do they have reading comprehension skills? In other words, you want to make sure that they have a solid foundation going into the teacher education program so that by the time they come out of it, they have developed the skills and knowledge necessary to be an effective classroom teacher.
And then I guess their first several years in the classroom, really that's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. And you'll find out, A, if someone is effective, and B, if they even like being in a classroom. And a lot of people leave in those first several years.
That's right. They simply find that it's not for them, or they have conflicts with other teachers, or most likely the administrators. being a former classroom teacher myself, I could tell it's a real shock going from a university to a classroom, because there's a disconnect often with what you learn in one place as opposed to another. In other words, you go to a teacher education program and you have a very you're taught a very idealized version of what classroom teaching is all about. You step foot into a classroom and it's a whole different world. So, and I think those who run teacher education programs know that. The key is making sure, I believe, that they have the foundational skills and knowledge to be able to build on what they learn in the classroom as they become a classroom teacher. Now, after those first 3 or 4 years, they get their feet under them. A teacher finds that it's easier. It's not easy, but it becomes easier the longer you're in the classroom. You start to develop some of those skills that you first learn in your teacher education program.
Terry, separate from the report we've been talking about from the National Council on Teacher Quality, I know that you have been doing a lot of analysis and writing about other programs outside of university teacher training schools, and you've written a lot about Teach for America. What is it that makes teachers who are trained under that program, Teach for America, so effective when they get into the classroom?
Well, this is a really great tie-in because it's those elements that the National Council of Teacher Quality looked at that really ties into what makes Teach for America so successful. It's admissions criteria. In other words, making sure that the right people are admitted to the program. And it's those foundational knowledge and skills, being able to have candidates that know the subject that they are teaching, that have a strong background in the content and be able to communicate that content to the children. So the same idea applies to both. And I think the National Council of Teacher Quality would agree that we can look at a program like Teach for America to give us guidance on how to strengthen teacher education programs. And really the way to do that is to make sure that we admit the right people, teach them the right things, and show them the right way to conduct themselves in the classroom.
That sounds like it could be really tough when you are an admissions person for an education school, because when you hear teachers talk, many of them talk about it as a calling, as something that they feel compelled to do. They want to be in public service, and that's how some teachers at least view it. So what do you say to someone who says, I really want to be a teacher, but based on the criteria in order to be effective a teacher, they may be choosing the wrong field? How do we do that?
Well, that is difficult because people do have the ability to make the decision whether to go in the profession or not. I think the key is to make sure that those who are in the workforce and decide later on that maybe teaching was for them, to have alternative programs that give a strong transition for those who are in the nonprofit or private sector to be able to go back into the classroom and become a teacher. We find that a lot of times that there are folks that regret not getting that state certification for teaching. They should be able to do that fairly easily, whether they're transitioning from, say, a private sector job or even the military, being able to go back into the classroom and be a classroom teacher. So the fact that we don't get them the first time around in a teacher education program doesn't mean they're lost forever. It just means that we need to find better ways to get them into the classroom when they finally decide that it is for them.
Well, it's a very interesting study, and our guest has been writing about it. We've been talking to Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research. The report is from the National Council on Teacher Quality, looking at teacher education programs. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being with us. And, of course, you can read all of Terry's analysis at johnlocke.org. Well, that is all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll come back again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.